time now is for Riley to do some, give some readings. I want to give a quick background. The first reading, so Root and Branch, we often do a reading from the Bible and one from not the Bible. I've got two from not the Bible today. And this one is from the book of Isaiah, which is part of the Hebrew Bible, the section called the Prophets. And it was written, there are different parts of it, they were written at slightly different times, but it was written, it's about a prophet who's talking to people who are in exile. The people of Israel have been kind of wrenched from home. They're living in a hostile empire, and they are, many of them are losing hope. So we're continuing this series about hope, and I thought this passage was appropriate. So,
First reading from Isaiah 40, verses 27 through 31. Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my God ignores my plight? Don't you know, haven't you heard, that the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, doesn't grow tired or weary? God's understanding is beyond human reach. God gives power to the tired and strengthens the powerless. Even youths will become tired and weary. The young will certainly stumble. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will rise up with wings like eagles. They will run and not be weary. They will walk and not get tired. Second reading. It is only for those without hope that hope is given. Walter Benjamin. And then Harlem by Langston Hughes. What happens to a dreamed bird? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? Or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat? Or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load. Or does it explode? Question mark.
Thank you. Thanks, Riley. Oh, I don't need that, but yeah, you probably take it. So I had, like I said, I got back 3 days ago from my honeymoon, and I had written actually a sermon. I actually couldn't sleep one night, and I wrote a whole sermon when I was there. Yeah, you can't get away from this place. But and I was excited. It was about language and what kind of this. Very theoretical, but I thought really smart thing about religion as a language and what it's like to learn a language and what it's like to not understand a language. And then when I got back, I was all pumped, and Tim was like, oh yeah, we're preaching about hope, and you're preaching about hope and social justice. Make sure you're done. And and so I wasn't in that space at all. I wasn't thinking about much more than the beach and language, these kind of strange things. Mostly because I couldn't speak the language there. But I pulled something together. But the way we do sermons here is really, at its best, dialogical. We like to have someone who's put some thought and kind of curated the topic and some of the, laid the groundwork. But it's really, that's just, I think of that as the kind of entree or the appetizer. Like, we're really trying to crack that open and bring all of us into the preaching moment, as they call it. So, but tonight, the point is, I'm gonna need that a little even more than ever, because I have some loose sketches, but I want it to be filled in with all of your help. So, I just got married, this is the proof, and it's cool. I was just telling Ben and Katie that each time someone asks me, you're married, well, that's not a question, but they say, you're married! I haven't, it's not been internalized, so I'm like, oh my God, you're right! That's, I just remembered just now when you said that. Like, it's not, it hasn't, you know, sunk all the way into my bones yet. But it's good. But one of the many, like, kind of challenging things of making this shift to, from a guy who still, like, feels like he's in his 20s, like he just graduated college, and doesn't really think about the future too much. And I, interestingly, There's brain research that says that men's brains are incapable of thinking too far into the future until they're like 26. I'm not making that up. There's a structural deficiency. You can read about this. In my case, it was 33, little delayed. But one of the challenging things about that transition was something that's a touchy topic for all of us maybe, but it was related to hope, and it was about thinking about my financial reality, including my financial future, but also past, which is like where I incurred these massive debts from in the first place, which is my overpriced education. And those things were, I wouldn't say I was feeling desperate or in despair about those things, about, oh, I'm gonna end up, penniless, or like I didn't have a good picture of what that would look like. But I would say that I didn't feel good about it. And I would say that the reason I didn't feel good about it was because I wasn't really, didn't want to look at it. I wasn't really even, like if you would ask me, you know, how much money do you actually owe the federal government in student loans? I wouldn't have been able to give you a number. Like I was like, a lot, yeah, you know, it's crazy. But but by not looking at it, there was something I was getting out of that deal, which was it kind of it felt pretty good. Like it felt like my inattention to that, my avoidance of it, was a nice little life raft. Like, yeah, the world is crazy, life is crazy, you never know what's gonna happen, but I've got this little buoy of avoidance. And part of the reason that was okay to avoid it, to avoid thinking about it, was because I was on my own. It was like, if I don't figure this out, it's just me to blame. I'm the only one who's gonna be hurt from it. But suddenly when you have another person in the picture, those kind of things need to be addressed. You need to kind of, that's a conversation you're supposed to have, right? I think on Carrie's Facebook, there was like 15 questions you're supposed to ask each other before you decide to get married. And I was like, oh no, I should not read that because I already got married. I can't, but I had done some of them. But you know, like a big one was about financial realities. Like what's your situation? And what do you expect? So we did have that talk, thankfully, but we were going to kind of sit down. We would talk about like, oh yes, when are we going to have the sit down financial talk? And we're like, oh, we'll get to it. And I realized I was avoiding that too. I was scared that the number was bigger than I thought. I was scared that because I didn't really know how I was going to pay them all off, like, there's this amazing thing that mirrors this avoidance strategy called deferment. You can defer. Some people know about deferment? Forbearance. So I'd done a little of that. I wasn't hopeless. I had this kind of optimistic attitude that somehow it was gonna be okay. So I think as I was thinking about this, I think there's something very different between hope and optimism. And I was thinking in an optimistic place, which included some denial. And I think, as the Walter Benjamin quote says, hope is only given to us for those without hope. And as that passage from Isaiah says, God comes to the ones who are tired and exhausted, that like the strength doesn't come to those who are already strong and ready to get stronger, that it comes to those who are weak. I don't think that passage is just like to reassure and comfort the people who are downtrodden and struggling. I think it's kind of part of the logic of hope. That the logic of hope is, we need to become hopeless. We need to become empty of hope in order to receive it. That you can't muster hope. You can muster optimism. You can say, oh, I think everything's going to be fine. I'm sure things are going to be all right. Or it'll take care of itself. Or it's going to be fine. But that's not hope. Hope, I think, is when you see how bad things really are. When you actually click on the U.S. Department of Education's website and look and see what the number really is. And that number, it turns out, was scary. And for a second, I felt hopeless. I felt, oh my God, that's worse than I thought. That's a big number. That's way more than I make in a few years. And I have to pay to live. I felt that hopeless. And I think that's why I didn't look. I think that's why we don't look, because we have this little sensor inside of us that kind of detects, like, I bet the situation is worse than you think. I bet it's more hopeless than you really think. I'm supposed to talk about social justice. Talking about myself, it relates. I think student loan debt is a big problem in the middle class in this country. I mean, I could talk about that. I'm not going to. I think financial insecurity is much more widespread than we like to talk about. We think that, oh, it's those other people, those poor people, and no one wants to admit the kind of often life deadening and life ruining effect of all those little anxieties about money that. Because we're in a society that doesn't really know how to care for each other. But I think that same thing happens to me. Part of the reason I didn't want to talk about social justice is, like, I haven't really thought about it too much lately. When I was little, when I was in high school, I was like Mr. Social Justice. When I was in college, I went to a lot of protests, the Iraq War. I watched, it was rekindled when Occupy happened a little bit. I was like, maybe there is hope. But in general, in this part of my life, I've kind of, and maybe some of you can relate to this, I've kind of settled into the same place where I was with my loans. I know things are bad in the world. I know things kind of are messy and possibly getting worse. I know some important things like racial justice in our country, kind of the big talk right now is, like, have things gotten better? Or they just kind of shifted to a different kind of oppression that's a little more subtle, a little harder to pin down, a little less in your face. Does anyone know what the doomsday clock is? It's right here in Chicago, at the University of Chicago. Some of the scientists who helped develop the nuclear bomb later were like, oh man, this was a bad idea. And so they made the doomsday clock, which they move a few minutes closer or further from midnight, depending on how at risk we are of total annihilation. during the Cold War, at certain moments, of high tense moments, it was really close to midnight. I think it got to like 2 minutes. You know that just a few weeks ago, they put it 2 minutes away from midnight, which is the closest it's been in a long time. In 2007, they added the environment to their considerations of global destruction. I kind of knew that things were not good. We all do. But I was in this place of, like, I said to myself, oh, it's hopeless. If I go to a protest, if I try to get involved, my involvement is not going to tip the scale. It's not going to do much. But I don't think I was really being hopeless. I think I was being optimistic. I was being optimistic because if I really confronted my lack of involvement, that would feel much worse. That would feel like, oh man, that really is hopeless. If I really faced the fact that, like, yeah, maybe we can't do anything to reverse global warming, maybe we are all doomed, or maybe history doesn't progress in beautiful, neat stages of increasing justice and peace. Maybe progress isn't real. Like, that would feel a lot worse. But then it hit me, like, that's the only way we can actually have hope. We can only have hope if we go to that place of none. You can't muster it. It has to be given. This passage talked about God giving people hope and strength. And I think there are moments in our lives when we're at the end of our rope and we're by ourselves and it's nighttime and God is the only one who I've found can give me that hope. But I think there's a kind of hope that relates to social justice that we can only get also by admitting our helplessness, our hopelessness. And it relates to race. So I'm white, if you didn't notice. And I often feel helpless about my role in a racist or at the very least, a structurally racist. I think I'm racist, it's in me. I'm part of all this. But I often feel helpless. I don't know what to do. I mean, I can be like, I'm cool. I try to treat people fairly, but like, I don't know what to do about my participation in this system. And I'm often, the way I respond to that is often, what should I do? What can I do? I should be doing something. How can I help? And it occurred to me that maybe that's the wrong strategy. That's me trying to muster hope. Maybe I can muster some kind of solution to this problem of racism. I can find it in myself, this strength and this vision, and make root and branch as crusader against racism. I can do it. And it occurred to me that the only way that doesn't work, that doesn't lead me to hope. I haven't found the magic answer through that. I think maybe the best I can do and the best a lot of us can do is to admit that we don't know what to do, to admit that it hurts us, it's painful to feel helpless in that way, to feel implicated in that way, to feel like that lack of control, that lack of self-possession or strength. But then it occurred to me, what would happen if I started saying to people instead of, oh yeah, we should try to figure something out, we should try to do something, what if I said, I don't know what to do, and that sucks and it makes me feel like crap. I feel helpless. And maybe someone else, if I said that to enough other people, maybe they would say, yeah, you know what, me too, I feel kind of, it seems like a hopeless situation, doesn't it? Like, in spite of all these improvements in the law, the situation still seems bad. I feel helpless too. I don't like being part of a racist society. It doesn't feel good. I like that time when I was in sixth grade and we were learning about Martin Luther King Jr. It was inspiring. It felt important, and it felt like things could get better. I don't like feeling that things can't get better. You might keep talking about it, and you might run into other people, and you might have conversations about it. Maybe you'll even talk to a black person, and you'll say, I don't know what to do. I feel helpless. I feel hopeless. And that might be a weird conversation to just go up to a random black person and say that, but maybe they're not random. But you might say that, and maybe they'll say, you know what? I appreciate your honesty. Why don't you come give me a hand with this thing I'm doing? And you might even give that person hope. You might both get some hope. You might receive hope from them because maybe there is something to do, and they might receive hope from you. I think it's a weird thing to talk about. It sounds a little abstract, but that's what they teach in organizing. The thing Obama used to do before he was the leader of the free world. They talk about getting in touch with your own helplessness, your own hurt, your own oppression, and they say that's the site of your greatest power. That's how we connect to one another. I think that's the only way that I can think of as a white person to connect with someone who's not white. Is to admit that feeling of helplessness too. That's my source of hope. Amen. I want to ask you all now, I talked way longer than I expected, but I want to ask for thoughts, if you have any responses to this, but also more than that, I'm interested in, are there instances of times you've received hope? By the way, when I finally looked at my number, that number on the screen, after it settled in hopelessness, it got way better. There was a number I could call next to it, 1-800 number. I called. The lady was so nice on the phone. She was so sweet. My dad told me that she would be nice because he's dealt with this kind of stuff. She talked about income-based repayment. She talked about public interest loan forgiveness, which Root and Branch may qualify for. Also, when I talked to Allison about it, it was so much better to get the number. And she's like, that's not that big of a deal. Everyone has a lot of debt these days. So, okay, so if anyone has a story where they've received hope from someone, or just anything that this has made you think about.